what the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want, we want, we want. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, American Exceptionalism, Myths and Realities. We'll be joined by Aaron Good, author of a recent article titled American Exception, Hegemony and the Dissimulation of the State. We're also joined today by activist and author Medea Benjamin. We'll be talking about American exceptionalism around the July 4th holiday. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's show, we look at American exceptionalism, myths and realities. Later in the show, we'll be joined by author and activist Medea Benjamin, but we begin the program in discussion with Aaron Good. Aaron Good is a doctoral student at Temple University, and he's the author of a scholarly article that was in Sage Publications' Administration and Society this past spring. The article is titled American Exception, Hegemony and the Dissimulation of the State. Aaron Good joins us by phone to talk about this article under the umbrella of today's theme. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, Aaron. This is Peter Phillips. I'd like you to explain your ideas, and what do you mean by hegemony and dissimulation of the state?
The title of the article is meant as a reference to the prevailing myth of American legitimacy that is American exceptionalism, of course. And it's a reference to Carl Schmitt's state of exception, which he saw as being a legal state in which the rule of law was basically suspended to deal with an emergency.
And Aaron, could you tell our listeners who Carl Schmitt was?
Carl Schmitt was a German political theorist who was writing during the crisis of the Weimar Republic after World War I, when Germany appeared to be at risk of undergoing a communist revolution. And so the elites in Germany needed to find a way to hold on to power and to keep from becoming communist while still being democratic to some degree, like with the Weimar Republic was a nominally democratic government, but they wanted to take some very harsh authoritarian steps in traditionally German fashion against the communists there. And so Carl Schmitt was writing and saying that you can suspend the rule of law for a time if it's an emergency, and that this is really necessary to be done if there's a threat to the state. And so this was called a state of exception, and the exception is an exception to the rule of law. And it eventually gives rise to the Nazi state, which created a perpetual state of exception for itself until it ended. And I argue that the U.S. has operated, since it became the global hegemon at the end of World War II, that the U.S. has operated in a state of exception, as Carl Schmitt described, even though it's not typically acknowledged outright by leaders. You can find references to this in foreign policy documents outlining grand strategy like NSC 68, where they say we can't really be bound by the rule of law as we go about trying to fight global communism. And so they create all of these institutions that operate in a state of exception, and that is to say above the rule of law around the world, and eventually it bleeds over into the domestic realm where we had domestic surveillance, suppression of radical democratic entities in civil society. What's done abroad eventually comes back home to affect what we would think of as democratic rights.
Well, Aaron Good, also in your title, American Exception, it is part of this myth of American exceptionalism, often coupled with triumphalism through the 19th century, right? We saw Manifest Destiny, right? And then, we saw the Monroe Doctrine leading up toward Manifest Destiny. And then up into the 20th century, we saw Teddy Roosevelt's corollary to that Monroe Doctrine. We keep seeing this further and further and further, how exceptional America believes and sees itself. And because of this exceptionalism that Americans have historically seen themselves as, better or superior because they have what has been historically claimed as a God-given right to overspread the continent and, of course, then the globe with the notion of self-government, right? Like democracy is some kind of gift from God that America delivers to the world. And this then in turn allows Americans to make exception to following rule of law, whether domestic or internationally. And that's something that you address in your article.
Yes, absolutely. And it becomes more apparent as the U.S. becomes a global empire, or at least the myths that you're speaking of take new during the ages of American imperialism. I mean, McKinley comes to mind. He argued that God had essentially told him that it was his duty to go and save the Filipino people and to establish these colonies. And, you know, the question was, what was he going to do with the Philippines, having more or less acquired them after the Spanish-American War?
Well, it's interesting, Aaron Good, because George W. Bush claimed God told him to invade Iraq.
Right.
So God talks in mysterious ways across the centuries.
And his instructions to American statesmen invariably seem to involve invading and or otherwise dominating very poor countries on the other side of the world.
I guess that's another part of the exceptionalist ideology. Quite an interesting one. Please continue.
So when the U.S. becomes a global empire, a more global empire in the 20th century, you see some of these things that become more pronounced later on during the Cold War, but after the Cold War as well. There's a coup in Honduras in the around 1912 that involves Sam Zamuri, who was a banana magnate. And he is unhappy with the Honduran government, who wants to tax his banana plantations down there. And so he decides he's going to put in a new government, and he recruits a mobster, a guy named Machine Gun Mahoney, and he bribes some of the local people in the Honduran government, and he finds another sort of soldier of fortune, mercenary fellow named Lee Christmas. And on a very small budget, he takes a boat down to Honduras and just overthrows the government with a little bit of bloodshed, but not very much, and on the cheap, really. And what's funny is that this is like really a miniature version and a sort of privatized version of what the CIA would do later. It does similar things, but on a much grander scale during the Cold War. Even in Guatemala, when they do something to go after Arbenz, who was a leader who had run afoul of American corporate interests, one of the guys who was responsible for sort of bringing it to the foreign policy establishment's attention that this was unacceptable was the very same Sam Zamuri. So the sort of straight line between these over the course of history between these practices up to the present day, these corporate interests sort of driving foreign policy, and then statesmen who justify it with rhetoric that appeals to some sort of mythical American mission. It's very striking when it's presented in that way, but it's usually obscured in history and in history books and in media. On the 4th of July, this is usually not the way that the discussion goes.
Aaron Good, I want to ask about American exceptionalism. You say that this is an exception to the rule of law. Yet, certainly in the U.S., everything is lawful. At least publicly, it's lawful, or at least defined that way. And so you have a government, you have a president, you have a Congress, and they pass laws, and all of this is kind of up front. But you also talk about state crimes against democracy, the theory put out by Lance DeHaven Smith, and then the deep state activities that Peter Dale Scott has talked to. We've certainly had him on our show more than once. So that there is a part of the state that doesn't follow law. And we can see that manifested in coups and various actions and certainly drones killing people around the world without due process or court rulings. So how is the state organized so that this kind of hegemonic control of what's really happening is hidden from America?
That was one of the key issues that I've been trying to address really for the last 5 years or so since I started to familiarize myself with a lot of this work. I think I was more conventional in my views years ago, and I even worked for Obama at one point on his campaign in 2008, which seems like a lifetime ago. But so the issue of how the state is able to have two faces or three faces, really, this is a central issue that I try to deal with. I came up with the term the tripartite state, which is an expansion on the idea of a dual state. The idea of a dual state argues that Yes, we have these institutions that we know and we're taught about in civics class, like court systems, the police, municipal governments, state governments, et cetera, et cetera. But we also have this security state, this national security state that doesn't operate like a democracy. It operates in more of an authoritarian way. It operates in a top-down manner and with a vast amount of secrecy. And the security state, the national security state that most people would acknowledge emerges, I mean, you see it's a more of a historical fact that this emerges during and after World War II. We know a lot about what it does, the CIA and the FBI, like many things have become a part of the historical record as far as like the things that they've done that don't seem to be quite lawful. But it's even more complicated, I think, than just a dual state. I think that there is something that's emerged that's this deep state that goes beyond just the formally organized parts of the government, that something has emerged really over the last 60 years or so that is bigger and more complicated and more nebulous, and that is this deep state that exists in addition to the formally organized public state and security state. So we have not just these government entities, but we have private intelligence gathering outfits. We have entities that operate without real control or as cutouts for the CIA or other intelligence entities. We have foreign governments, intelligence agencies. They're even less transparent than our own non-transparent intelligence agencies for us. We have the relationship between organized crime and the national security state, the intelligence agencies. The one obvious commonality, or what becomes obvious after enough time spent studying them, is that these all tend to serve and benefit what Peter Dale Scott calls the overworld of private wealth, politically active private wealth, that their power has grown immensely through the use of these institutions and entities, and they've made the government and the political establishment even less receptive to appeals to what would be in the public good or what would be in anybody's concept of justice. They've corrupted what we would think of as democracy.
Certainly, Peter Dale Scott talks about a deep state that's active throughout American history, going back to the Constitution and the formation thereof, and comes about intermittently in terms of repression of democracy when democracy movements become too strong or challenge the elites in some way. And that, of course, after the Cold War, and then now a permanent war on terror, which is literally anybody in the world can be labeled a terrorist, and so that's why we have 700, 800 military bases all over the world to control people, democracy movements, or resistance movements to capital. And that capital is not just in the United States, it's transnational. There's capital all around the world with common interests of protecting themselves from democracy movements in various ways that would tax them or regulate their profits in some manner. Do you see that way, this transnational corporate class involved?
Yeah, absolutely. The interests are transnational or supranational, even, to a large degree. You recently had on your show William Robinson, who does fantastic work. I haven't read his new book on the current crisis of capitalism, but I've read his other work on democracy promotion, which is all a part of this sort of hegemony-promoting regime that we have in place. But one area where I would disagree with him a little bit is that the emergence of supranational institutions is a relatively new phenomenon. I think that it has been the case since really the end of World War II, at the very least. When you look at some of the earliest covert operations and the more infamous ones, they involved the interests of multiple parties and from multiple countries. For example, it was British interests that were threatened when Mossadegh tried to nationalize Iran's oil in the early 1950s, and it was these connections between the British and the American establishment that eventually led to the CIA carrying out that coup after the British had basically been kicked out of Iran. They couldn't really do it themselves, or they would have. The CIA was able to do that, and the interests of the transnational capitalist class that transcended borders, those were really the key and decisive factor there. Also, when Lumumba was killed in 1961, it was a combination of British, Belgian, and American interest. And still to this day, it's trying to determine exact responsibility or allocate proportional responsibility for that event is very difficult in terms of saying who is more to blame than the others. They all had a hand in the death of Lumumba and what happened to the Congo. But as is often the case with much of our history the last 50, 60 years, the actual reality of what happened is obscured. And this obscuring of very important political and historical realities has really risen to kind of a crisis level. I think you guys have, in a way, referred to it as a truth emergency, and I think that that's appropriate. But it's historical. It goes beyond just the media environment of the present day. It's a historical phenomenon that we have to deal with.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, American Exceptionalism, Myths and Realities. We're joined by Aaron Good, and we're speaking about a recent article he did called American Exception, Hegemony and the Dissimulation of the State. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Speaking with Aaron Good, a doctoral student at Temple University. He's the author of a scholarly article in Sage Publications Administration and Society this past spring. The article, American Exception, Hegemony and the Dissimulation of the State. I would like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we're looking at American Exceptionalism, Myths and Realities, here today. And Aaron Good, your article, it's kind of a tour de force. It includes everybody from John Locke to Thomas Hobbes, Max Weber, Carl Schmitt, C. Wright Mills to Peter Dale Scott. And you're looking at these various theories here. And of course, we've already touched on the dual state that you mentioned here with Ola Tonander, and also what Peter Dale Scott calls parapolitics. And then again, we want to come back to your tripart state analysis. But before we do that, there's one area here that I think we've not gotten into yet, and that's Lance DeHaven Smith's State Crimes Against Democracy, or SCADS theory. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it ties into what you're talking about here? And I think that'll be a decent springboard for you to go back into the tripart state theory that you develop in your conclusion.
Right. Well, Lance is a public administration scholar, and he had a long and distinguished career and had written, you know, over a dozen books, sort of in a more conventional vein. And he was an expert in Florida state politics. And when the Florida election, the election of 2000, when Florida was stolen, the presidential election, when Florida's electoral votes were essentially stolen, and it led to the election of Bush, and he found that multiple felonies were committed during the election and the recount process that unfolded, it radicalized him and made him realize that criminality abounds in these higher circles, and that there seems to be little recourse when elites commit crimes. And if elites can commit crimes with impunity, this problematizes the way that we try to think of democracy and the way that law should be administered, and it really damages the rule of law enormously. And so he started to focus on what he called state crimes against democracy. And he looked at political assassinations, illegal invasions, illegal wiretapping, all of these issues that have had a profound effect on American democracy. And the political assassinations of the 60s would be a case of what you were speaking to earlier, how democratic movements are damaged or destroyed through illegal means. Somebody like John Kennedy, who was an opportunist at times, and he certainly was in many ways a person who carried out the dictates of power while he was in office. But he also clashed with elements that have since gone on to be mostly unchallenged. He said he wanted to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. It's hard to imagine any president after him saying such a thing. He said that during his clash with U.S. Steel, America's big corporate entity, that all businessmen were sons of bitches. And that's what his father had told him, and that he never believed him until now. And it's hard to imagine a leader saying that today. So what State Crimes Against Democracy does is it tries to look at how these leaders are removed by the prevailing power system and how we're not able to examine or investigate these issues. It's even stigmatized to talk about these things. The latest thing that we're working on is a book that's going to look at why we cannot even speak to the things that are happening to us. We have a de facto authoritarian system in a lot of ways, and yet we're not allowed to speak about it. And so the State Crimes Against Democracy label is a way to name these things so that at least we can start to speak about them in an academic fashion and look for patterns and think of ways to prevent them and think of ways to deal with them and their effects and to understand them going forward.
Well, Aaron Good, Lance DeHaven-Smith also did a book, Conspiracy Theory in America, part of the Mark Crispin Miller series, UT Press, where I think he tackles some of those issues. And certainly Peter and I and Project Censored have tackled the problems of the conspiracy theory label. And institutionally, it's been very difficult. I know you've had your own experiences, but it's been very difficult to get this kind of analysis really published and taken seriously on a number of levels. I think that's changing. I think that is shifting. Certainly, on one hand, we have the Stephen Kinzer's former New York Times writing overthrow, and apparently it's permissible to tell the stories and have some of the narratives, but it's a no-no to have an overarching theoretical construct that challenges American hegemony and exceptionalism. And of course, that's what we're talking about here, right? And that's what Peter Dale Scott's Deep State talks about. That's what Lance DeHaven-Smith Skads talks about, even though there are some differences in those analyses. That leads us to your conclusion in your article. You talk about a tripart state. And so tell us again, I know you mentioned it earlier in our discussion, but again, how do you come to this conclusion about a tripart state as a way or an analytic mold to look at what's happening around the world today?
The analysis of just a security state and a public state did not include everything that seems to fall into the realm of what could be considered the state or the entity that has a monopoly on the use of violence within a particular area. And so the deep state is something that you hear talked about more in the mainstream press, and that's this hegemonic power structure that has the power of the state and yet is obscured from us and is almost somewhat taboo to talk about, although, as you say, it is sort of, the taboos are sort of lessening as the crisis in capitalism and democracy becomes more acute. I think some of these taboos are relaxing a little bit, and so this is a positive sign. But the deep state consists of the overworld of private wealth, what we would think of as Wall Street, the underworld of organized crime, the relationship between the two, the international financial institutions, and private and foreign intelligence agencies, the Saudi intelligence agencies that are always sort of acting on behalf of U.S. corporate interests over in the Middle East and elsewhere, and these private entities like Booz Allen Hamilton or even Lockheed Martin has acted as an intelligence agency capacity almost, that these form a deep state that is even more complicated and unaccountable than a bureaucratically organized intelligence agency like the CIA.
So this deep state has elements of public, private, class, and underworld crime elements that collaborate on various very, well, we would assume, illegal activities. And overtly, I mean, this could be assassinations and manipulations of the stock market and a variety of things. Overtly, however, we have the legitimate government, or supposedly a legitimate government, if you believe the hegemony of ideas about American exceptionalism, that operates increasingly in a mode of unlawfulness. Certainly Obama's use of drones is unlawful in the world in terms of international law, invasions of other countries, occupations, special forces around the world, and killing people. So that would be what William Robinson would describe as an increasing challenge to the legitimacy of the state, is the public awareness of these operations. So they're both underworld, they're both private and deep, but also overtly, as well, this concentration of power occurs, more people are understanding that this is illegitimate and questioning the whole operation. How do you see that coming down in the future here?
That is going to be one of the key, or maybe the key question going forward, is what is going to be the outcome of what Habermas would describe as a legitimation crisis or a crisis of legitimacy. And capitalism has faced these crises where the contradictions between what is the myth of the prevailing order, the contradictions between the myths and the realities are too great. I think that we are experiencing one of these now, and it could go, as William Robinson points out, it could go three ways. It could go in a sort of revolutionary direction, or you could have a reformist direction, or you could have a kind of fascist direction and a fascist state of affairs that would emerge. We would obviously be hoping for a drastic revolution or reform to the status quo as it exists now, not knowing exactly what form that would take, but something, if you are in favor of peace and social justice, you would hope for something along those lines. The infrastructure for a deep state that surveils everyone and can manipulate politics and manipulate information, the flow of information, and people's perceptions of realities, the capacity for that to take on new and more totalizing and terrifying forms, that seems to be emerging. And Snowden is probably, his revelations are the tip of an iceberg, you could say. And whether these forces are able, a small minority is going to be able to control the politics of the world going forward is a key question. This issue of the transnational corporate class that is totally united is, it seems that there is a slight problem with this in that there are capitalists in Russia and capitalists in China, and their interests seem to be conflicting with Western capitalist interests. And so the older understanding of states and nation states being adversarial at times, I think that that is still relevant, and that perhaps that's an issue, that's an area where there is some hope, because some of these states that might want a multipolar world, because they wouldn't want to live in a world where everything is dictated by the dominant power, the U.S., that they would have an actual interest in advocating for the rule of law internationally and some kind of multipolar world. And so even though these are states with authoritarian histories and tendencies, like China and Russia, absolutely, they would have what would seem to be an interest in the rule of law being applied internationally and domestically in their own countries. And perhaps there's some hope to the apparent belligerence of the United States towards these countries going forward. If war can be avoided, then this changing power structure is actually a source of hope, I think.
Well, Aaron Good, it's also seemingly the case after 9/11 that as the United States used its exception as a result of its exceptionalist mythological mindset, that many other countries, including China and Russia, also used that as a rule for exception to the rule of international law. So they do all seem to avoid or ignore international law when it behooves them and adopt or support it in inverse when it also behooves them, particularly against other parties or competitive parties.
Yes, I think that that is definitely true. And you can't, I would not want to be putting a halo on any of these foreign leaders. The way that Aristotle describes oligarchy is that it eventually can turn into something more democratic when one of the powers realizes that it's in his interest to make an appeal to the people. And in that way, you can end up with a more democratic outcome, and it doesn't even require that any of these other competing powers be wearing a white hat or be totally pure in motives.
Aaron, we need to wrap up here, and I'd like to kind of summarize a little bit here what we're trying to say. It seems that the legitimacy of the state around the world, states around the world, is increasingly in question as deep state, security state apparatuses commit acts that are in violation of humanitarian beliefs and international law. All states seem to be doing that to varying degrees, U.S. included, and U.S. taking the lead on it in many cases. Where we're going with that, where that will happen, Robinson talks about the 21st century fascism. We would certainly hope that that won't be the case, but there's an increasing involvement both of the Chinese billionaires and the Russian billionaires in this transnational class of capital and how it flows around the world in terms of repressing democracy movements. So all of that leaves us with a big question here about what we celebrate on the 4th of July and what the American government and our history is about. American exceptionalism is the theme of today's show, and we certainly thank you very much for kind of laying this out a bit for us. There's a lot to think about here.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
We've just been speaking with Aaron Good, a doctoral student at Temple University, author of an article from Sage Publications Administration and Society, American Exception, Hegemony and the Dissimulation of the State. Today's theme is American Exceptionalism, Myths and Reality. And after this musical break, we'll be back with author and activist Medea Benjamin. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Continuing our theme of American exceptionalism, myths and realities, we are now joined by Medea Benjamin. She's co-founder of Code Pink and the human rights organization Global Exchange. She's been organizing against U.S. military interventions and promoting the rights of Palestinians and calling for no war on Iran. She's the author of 8 books, including most recently on drone warfare, Killing by Remote Control. We are joined by Medea Benjamin by phone. Medea, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. How nice to be on with you, Mickey and Peter.
Thank you so much for taking time out.
Great to have you, Medea. We've been talking about American exceptionalism, and what really that means is exception to the rule of law. And increasingly, the U.S. government internationally is violating laws, killing people without trial and due process. And yet, American people don't really understand that. Who is the power behind this formation of what many have called a deep state in terms of the U.S. government? How do you see it from your perspective in Washington?
It is just wild being here in Washington this whole idea that whatever America does is good. If we violate international law, it's okay because we're good. If we keep people in indefinite detention, that's okay because we're good. If we have nuclear weapons, that's fine because we're good, and on and on and on. So even if we do bad things, they're not bad when we do them. Who keeps that in place? I don't know. Maybe behind the curtain there's this big super-duper propaganda machine that keeps it all going, but I think it's just called the superpower syndrome.
Well, Medea Benjamin, you've been active for a very, very long time, pointing out the hypocrisies of the U.S. state, certainly pointing out human rights violations both at home and abroad. Let's catch up a little bit. You've been very busy again recently, and I believe you just came back from Korea. Is that correct?
Yes, we were part of a group of 30 women for the third time in 70 years to have crossed the DMZ from North to South Korea.
Tell us about that. What was that about, and what did you think it accomplished?
It was aimed to shed light on the fact that there hasn't been a peace treaty between the North and South. There's been a temporary armistice agreement that goes back to the 50s. It was supposed to turn into a peace agreement, and that never happened. Also, to shed light on the tragedy of millions of Korean families who've never been able to see each other because they're either in the North or the South and they can't go from one side to the other. And also the need to have women involved in the peacemaking process. So those were our three goals. And we're back now in the U.S., but trying to keep the momentum going, trying to have a meeting with Ban Ki-moon from the U.N., with John Kerry, and to be stirring the pot to say it's time to put some pressure on the Korea situation. And when we talk about U.S. exceptionalism, we certainly have reason to criticize the North Korean government for its repressive, authoritarian nature. The U.S. isn't helping because it does these yearly military exercises with South Korea that simulate an invasion of North Korea. And it encouraged South Korea to be building new military bases. And so once again, we have the militarization of the entire peninsula, and the U.S. supposedly doing it in the name of the good guys. But really what it's doing is keeping them there from being any process of reconciliation, or more important, is a process of reunification.
Certainly one concern that we've seen recently was the passage of TPP, and Obama's pretty much going against his own party in that regard. What's going on in Washington, D.C. around this? The Democrats were standing with the American people to a certain extent on this, but it's going forward, and Obama's pushing it.
Well, wasn't that extraordinary to watch? And it's not done yet, because the vote still hasn't come up, so there's plenty of fight left to go. But unfortunately, in the last round, the people lost because Obama teamed up with the Republicans and with the most pro-corporate Democrats like Dianne Feinstein. And yes, it was quite amazing to see this coalition of groups that included the trade unions, who are usually with the Democratic Party on whatever they want, and the grassroots organizations and the groups like Public Citizen, the trade groups, and the people in general. And it was a really very hot and hard-fought battle. And at one point, it looked like the people had won. And then the Obama charm, or the Obama pressure, came on full-blown, with Obama going right to the Congress itself, even attending the congressional baseball game to put pressure on, and turning enough votes, just enough votes in their favor to pass the fast track. So we will see what happens when the final vote comes down on the TPP, but it's not looking good for the people right now.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking about American exceptionalism today, myths and realities. Right now, we're speaking with author and activist Medea Benjamin. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Medea Benjamin, we were speaking earlier in the program with Aaron Good about an article he did titled American Exception, and it talked about U.S. hegemony. And the riff on the title was that because of this mythology of exceptionalism, the United States makes exception to the rule of law at home and abroad. And the TPP seems like a full-out corporatist assault on both domestic sovereignty and in terms of international trade. Is that right?
Well, yes, and it is really amazing the way the Obama administration has staked its reputation on a treaty that violates U.S. sovereignty and goes against what one would think would be the principles of the importance of having U.S. law be primary and not allowing foreign companies to sue U.S. government. So, yes, the TPP is a terrible example of how so many inside the Beltway here have become more aligned with the wishes of the corporate world than what's good for the American people.
So we're speaking with Medea Benjamin. She's a co-founder of Code Pink as well as Global Exchange, author of numerous books, including Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. We're talking about American exceptionalism, U.S. hegemony. Just got done talking a little bit about Medea's return from Korea. Also a little wrap on the TPP. And Medea Benjamin, Peter Phillips has a question for you on another international issue. Peter?
Well, certainly there's been a lessening of tension with Cuba, and from your bio, I saw that you lived there for 3 years. And so what's your take on ambassador exchange and full relations with issues at play here, Guantanamo and U.S. intervention internally? How do you see what's happening in Cuba today?
Well, it's fabulous that there is so much movement on this after over 50 years of a policy that's trying to use all kinds of means, and a lot of them horrible terrorist kinds of means, of even supporting people who blew up an airline or blew up a hotel killing Italian tourists, and now moving towards diplomatic relations. We're excited that the embassies on July 20th are going to turn into real embassies. But let's remember the U.S. is still trying to dictate what the Cuban government and the Cuban economy should look like. And that is worrisome because embedded in U.S. law is that we are supposed to be giving U.S. taxpayer money to groups that are in opposition to the Cuban government. And now I'm glad you brought up, Peter, the issue of Guantanamo, because talk about U.S. exceptionalism. The U.S. poo-poos the whole idea that there's even an issue about Guantanamo being returned back to the hands of the Cubans. You know, we have over 800 U.S. military bases around the world. There's no other country in the world that comes near to the United States in terms of foreign military bases. And yet when countries like Cuba or the people in Okinawa in Japan or the people in Korea say, hey, this is our land, give it back to us, the U.S. acts like this is a ridiculous request. So while it's important to keep moving towards normalizing relations with Cuba, lifting the U.S. travel ban, you know, we still are not allowed to go hang out on a beach in Cuba, lifting the embargo, let's not forget that issue of Guantanamo, the importance of closing the prison there and giving that land back to the Cubans.
Well, speaking of the issue of torture, and again, the double standards here, the hypocrisy that is also just historically so much a part of American exceptionalism, the myth and the reality, right? And the reality that you're describing, of course, is directly contradictory to what the purported principles happen to be. And you, Medea Benjamin, have also noted that this same kind of hypocrisy exists on things like women's rights in Afghanistan. It exists in the ways in which that the United States supports Israel against their occupation of Palestine. It exists in ways where the United States allies itself with Saudi Arabia. Could you talk a little bit about some of these areas of interest? You certainly have experience in these areas.
Well, I think most Americans would like our government to be supporting democratic institutions overseas. And instead, what we have is a host of governments that we're supporting that are really thugs. When you look at Egypt today, a government that came to power through a coup that killed 2,000 people and, according to Amnesty reports, rounded up 40,000 and put them into prison, a country that is now committing violations that are worse than the worst days of the Mubarak regime. The U.S. government even put out a report last week about how bad things are in Egypt. But it said in the report, well, they're really bad, but you know what? We should keep giving them money because we want to have influence, and we have to work with them in this war on terror. And, you know, for the Egyptian people, that's like, wait, our government is the terrorist government. It's terrorizing us. So that's just one example. You mentioned Saudi Arabia. If there is one Arab country in the entire world that is spreading terrorism around the world, it's Saudi Arabia, from the Wahhabi ideology that it spread to the support for al-Qaeda-type groups throughout the Middle East, and a country that beheads its own people in public squares, that punishes people with flogging them in public squares for writing something on the Internet. This is our ally, Saudi Arabia. So it is sickening to be in Washington, D.C., and see former congresspeople who then go and become lobbyists for countries like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt, and of course Israel. We have the huge lobby groups like AIPAC that do everything they can not only to keep the U.S. supporting their repressive practices internally, but to do things like quash the negotiations that are going on with Iran right now. And I think it's so dangerous that from the Saudis to the Israelis and all their lobbyists in Washington, they're going to try to take these nuclear talks and destroy them.
Medea, you mentioned the mighty Wurlitzer as part of a kind of hegemonic media domination in the U.S. relative to American exceptionalism. And there's certainly a celebration of being an American periodically, year-round. Certainly the 4th of July holiday is one of those, Memorial Day another. But even private events like the Super Bowl is very much that as well. Do you see any direction, a positive direction, where the hypocrisy of this will be gradually seep into the American consciousness? The Occupy movement gave us the 1% versus 99%. Is there a better understanding emerging about what American exceptionalism means?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think when you look at polls that have been done of the younger generation, they don't buy a lot of this stuff. We were just at an event that the libertarian group, the Cato Institute, put on when they looked at what do millennials think about foreign policy. And they're very much non-interventionists. They're not unilateralists. They don't want the U.S. to go in and try to socially engineer other people's countries. And I think that's pretty much true for a lot of the younger generation who grew up seeing how awful the U.S. has done in its invasion of Iraq, how that led to the creation of ISIS, how it led to more enemies and more extremism around the world. The American people in general are tired of wars, which is why it's been very hard to sell even the latest attempt to send more troops into Iraq. I go to these hearings, Peter, in Congress, and these Congress people on both sides of the aisle, but particularly the Republicans, they're saying to our Secretary of Defense and the head of the military, you're not doing enough in Iraq. You should send in more troops. There aren't enough troops there. And basically, these guys understand that, one, more troops isn't going to mean anything in terms of defeating ISIS, and they have a better sense of the American public that really won't stand for another round of significant numbers of U.S. troops in the Middle East. So I would say that's a positive thing.
Well, we're speaking with Medea Benjamin, and I'd like to remind you all that you are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You know, Medea, you mentioned sort of this among the millennial generation, this more of a sense of non-intervention and sort of taking things in a different direction. And Peter mentioned, of course, the Occupy movement. Of course, groups like Free and Equal sort of do this beyond the two-party system. Two books ago, Ralph Nader did a book about, you know, sort of transcending the right-left paradigm and building allies. mobilize where we can against this massive encroaching sort of corporate state or American exceptionalism. In many cases, a lot of people have argued that it's more like a new breed of 21st century fascism. But there are movements of hope. There is light coming through, even though we see these things happening. And I wanted to mention something that you know a lot about in this light, particularly drones, drone policy, and drone warfare, right? And that's sort of part of this idea of no boots on the ground. We can sort of fight the wars like video games, and only the bad guys die. There's been a couple of things that have happened, not in the distant past here, more recently. President Obama really was kind of forced to admit that they didn't really know who they were killing. Of course, he had a very selective and insulting apology about some of the drone victims. But we've also seen PTSD and some other people who are involved in drone piloting walking away from this program. And again, you wrote Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. What are your thoughts on where this is heading?
Well, I think this is a great example of how when citizens get involved and try to expose what their government is doing, you can have a real impact. And out there in California, the Code Pink group, together with groups like Veterans for Peace and others, have been going out to the Creech Air Force Base where the drones are being piloted, and they've been doing vigils there constantly. Folks in upstate New York at the Hancock Air Force Base have been exposing that. We've been going to the White House, the CIA, the Pentagon. We brought drone victims to the United States. We went to visit with them in Yemen and in Pakistan. And all of this work has had an impact. It's helped to change public opinion about the use of drones. It forced the government to take a covert program that they wouldn't even admit that they were doing and talk about it and have, quote, new rules about how they would use the drone. It's reduced the number of drone strikes. It forced our government to give some compensation to the families. It's not good enough. We want the drone warfare to end totally, but it does show that citizen involvement can lead to policy changes.
So, Medea Benjamin, we had Kathy Kelly on the program a while ago, and certainly she is often some of the same circles. She spent time in Iraq, Afghanistan, has spoken out, certainly on the drone wars. Again, looking at this idea of American exceptionalism, what I also hear you saying here is there are avenues for democratic change, and there are movements and people certainly making a change. And it's not just, of course, Code Pink has done a lot, but there are a lot of different people. And again, Peter and I both teach college, and we're seeing a lot among young people, like we mentioned the millennial generation here. We're seeing young people wake up, saddled with over $1 trillion collective student debt, lack of opportunities economically. We're seeing people really get engaged in a number of levels. Are you seeing some of that too where you are?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's exciting to see how many young people are getting involved with all kinds of issues, whether it's issues around the environment or immigration or legalizing marijuana or gay marriage or the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, you name it. So I'm feeling quite good about the younger generation. And I think it's the job of us older folks to really be mentors and to be supporting a lot of the young groups, particularly around the Black Lives Matter. There's been so much great leadership coming from young people of color, a lot of them women of color, and that's very inspiring. I think people need to see that young people can get involved. I wish there were a stronger movement around the student debt, because I think that's an issue that could really win on. I think we should have a movement that is for free college education for everyone, like Bernie Sanders has been talking about. And I see in other countries how many gains they've made. But yes, there's a lot of young people involvement. And I just have to say, because you mentioned Kathy Kelly's name, what a hero she is in this work in the peace movement, and that she does a lot of work with young people and travels around and talks at universities all the time. And it's people like her that help bring in a new generation into the peace work.
Medea, we're increasingly aware of a national security state that's spying on us, monitoring who we are, reading all of our communications, building files, etc. This is penetrating down even to the local police in every city in the country through fusion centers. We also see private military companies that fill in for the government, military in various capacities around the world. And, of course, here in the United States, private military companies running the prisons and that. So How do you see this? Are we really faced with a police state pending in the next decade to an even greater degree than it is today?
Well, I think we've certainly been moving in that direction. And living here in Washington, D.C., there's about 40 different police entities, and they're all over you. I am encouraged, in light of Edward Snowden's revelations, how much we've been able to raise this issue, to get concerned about it, to push for changes, and we have to keep pushing that. But, Peter, I think it's also important that people don't feel so intimidated by this police state that they don't exercise their rights. So we have to keep telling people that the only way we're going to change that, if we get out there and work on these issues, not only the issue of trying to get our privacy back, but the other issues that we care about, the environmental issues, the gay rights issues, the immigration issues, the Black Lives Matter issues, all of those issues. So don't be intimidated by the security state. Be angry about it and use it as part of your organizing.
Indeed, Medea Benjamin, and that is a fine note for us to end the program on in terms of American exceptionalism. And there are a lot of things about American history and American movements for social justice that are exceptional, and it's those movements that we should consider modeling. And certainly you mentioned your opinion of Kathy Kelly being a heroic individual. We certainly agree, and we'd also put you in the same category, and certainly young people and others can learn a lot by watching what you do, and we know that you are, every time we turn around, there you are. So we appreciate your tireless efforts and your tireless fights for social justice, Medea Benjamin.
Well, thank you, but let me just take exception to your use of exceptionalism in saying it in the positive way, because we learn a lot from the struggles overseas and the way that people are organizing such creative ways in places like Spain and Greece right now, and certainly in all throughout Latin America and the Middle East. So let's not be exceptional in those terms either, but really keep our spirits open to learn from people all over the world who are struggling for a better world.
Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We want liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the U.S. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.